Thanks, Chloe. So, hello, my name is Liz, and I'm going to tell you the story today of how I went from being Liz Ball, breast cancer surgeon, to Liz O'Riordan, breast cancer patient. I'm not going to take you on a journey of my step from A to B. I've kept a blog about that. What I am going to do is focus on a couple of issues and lessons I've learned along the way, and maybe make you think a little differently about how you treat patients, because patients are people too. Now, I want you to think about a time when you heard bad news. Was it waiting to hear whether you'd failed your driving test, failing the exam, finding out whether someone you loved had been ill? Can you remember how you felt that day, what you were wearing, what time of day it was, what was said, the emotion? I was about to go through it myself. It all started for me in September 2014, where I noticed a lump in my right breast, and I went into the waiting room of fear. Everyone in that breast waiting room, you imagine the worst. The illogical part of your head said, oh my God, it's cancer, I'll be dead in a year. Even though I knew, I'm young, it feels like a cyst, that bit in my brain was saying, oh my God. Everyone said, it'll be fine. And it was. In March last year, I noticed a lump in my other breast. And although I thought, it's a cyst again, I was still sat in that waiting room thinking, oh my God, it's cancer. Everyone said, it'll be fine. I had an ultrasound this time. And it was. It just showed cysts. Fast forward 3 months to July last year, I had another lump in the same breast. And I wasn't worried this time. I'd had a normal mammogram. I'd had a normal ultrasound. I told my mum, and she said, will you get it checked out? So I did, just for her. Now, I was being treated in a hospital where my husband works, not where I work. And I was sat in the waiting room saying hi to the nurses and the receptionist because I work there myself. Hi, how are you? Not expecting it to be anything. And the mammogram was normal. And the consultant radiologist said, do you want to look at the scan? And I said, yeah, because it's going to be a cyst. And I looked, and I saw a cancer. And in that moment, a light bulb went off, and the next 5 years of my life flashed in front of my eyes. Imagine how you would feel, men and women, if you saw a cancer. You know what chemo, what surgery, what radiotherapy means. You know all the worst-case scenarios, the complications. No learning curve, no slow drip feed of information. So I then was very lucky. I only had to wait 3 days to get my results confirmed. I had time to warn my mum and say, I'll be telling you in 3 days I've got cancer. But they rushed it through for me. If it was you, how long would you want to wait to find out that you had cancer? An hour? A day? A week? 2 weeks? How long do we make our patients wait? Especially over the bank holiday weekends when you're waiting for all the scans to come back. Those 2 nights were the worst nights of my life with the internet at my fingertips. I remind you of a story when I went to tell a patient that she'd got a skin recurrence that was cancer. And I went into the room, and before I could say hello, she said, it's cancer, isn't it? How do you know? And she said, you brought the breast care nurse with you. When it's good news, you come alone. I'd never thought about that before. And I told my husband this, and the breast care nurse called us through. And my consultant, who's a close friend, was in tears, and the other breast consultant was in tears, and my husband was in tears, and I was, right, fine, cancer, I know. What happened next was I went to have a biopsy and a clip because they forgot to put it in, and then a mammogram, and it's bloody painful when they mammogram a bruised biopsied breast. I then went straight to a CT scan with an MRI 2 days later, see the oncologist in a week, to start chemo in a week. No time for things to sink in. The third time I got bad results was when I went back to get the results of my mastectomy. So a bit of background. Have you got a glass of water? I'm a bit dry. Sorry. Thank you. So the ultrasound showed the tumour was 2.5 centimetres and it was mixed ductal and lobular. Thank you, Chloe. The MRI showed it was 5.5 by 5.5 centimetres. Nodes were negative. And my last MRI at the end of chemo showed almost a complete response. I'd had my mastectomy and reconstruction, and I was really happy to go this time. I dressed up. I got my hat on to cover my bald head. I'd put a bit of makeup on, well, as much makeup as you can when you don't have eyelashes and eyebrows. And I remember being in that waiting room thinking, I feel so sorry for all those other couples around me who are obviously waiting to hear bad news. I'm never going to have to go through that again. And we sat down. It was the 23rd of December, and my consultant said, there was 131 millimetres of residual cancer left, and I thought she said 13. And then I looked at her and said, no, you said 13 centimetres. I didn't know my breast was that big. And then she said, and both nodes were positive. And the floor just went from under me. But because, as we all know what we have to do in the clinic, she still had to examine me, check the nipple, check the drain scars, talk about surgery or radiotherapy to the axilla, consent me for a clearance, give me a date. All I wanted to do was run out of that room screaming. Then I had to go with a breast care nurse and actually told her just how much pain I was in, but it was still, I can't take any of this in. I remember every single detail of that conversation, and it was the 23rd of December, not the best Christmas present to give my friends and family. In an ideal world, you'd only tell someone they had cancer, and then you let them go, let it sink in and come back. But we all know with the constraints of the NHS, the time pressures, the ticking clocks, especially with a screening patient, you say, hello, you've got cancer, take me through your history, take your clothes off, let me examine you, let me consent you for an operation. It is too much to take in. And it's easy in the clinics to get irritated, frustrated, annoyed. I used to have double maths on a Friday where I'd spend all day breaking bad news, and it's really hard to give the best of yourself to that patient. But take the time to read the notes, to compose yourself, to do it properly, because it is the most important thing you will do in that patient's life. They will remember every single second of that consultation. The second thing I'm going to talk about is language, and it's the basics. The amazing Kate Granger, who I hope you've all heard of, talked about the Hello, My Name Is campaign. Every healthcare professional at every point of contact says, hello, my name is. Do you do it every time? Do you introduce everyone in the room with you? I had excellent care. The only people who didn't do it were the phlebotomists. And I used to not mind having blood, but when you have blood taken a lot during chemo, it's sore, it's painful. None of them said hello. Is it okay for a stranger to stick a needle in you without saying who they are? The next thing I'm going to talk about are catchphrases, which we all have. Sorry, a bit dry. I use catchphrases to break the ice when I'm breaking bad news. Some I've nicked from people. So from my own surgeon, I borrowed, I'll be wide awake, you'll be fast asleep, when talking about an anaesthetic. That breaks the ice. I say when I'm talking about post-op recovery, so your husband's going to be on house cleaning duties for 2 weeks to 5 years. That always gets a laugh. I've borrowed from you for Fiona McNeil in the past. Your breasts are sisters, not twins, when trying to describe asymmetry. My own surgeon told me, which I love, after my clearance, you're not allowed to lift anything heavier than a wine glass for a month. Fantastic. Feel free to borrow that one. But we have catchphrases that are bad, and you don't realize what you're saying. We see the entire spectrum of breast cancer, from that 2 millimeter low-grade DCIS to the 25-year-old who's pregnant with inflammatory breast cancer. And you want to give patients some idea of hope. And I've heard myself say, you're lucky we caught it early. This is a good one to have. You're cured. No one is lucky to get cancer. It's never good to have cancer caught early. And you're never cured. Just have a think about the routine things you say to patients, because we remember every single word. Another example of bad language was when I was having my chemotherapy appointment to go through the consent form, and we'd covered hair loss, and we then moved on to fertility. And my fertility discussion went like this. So there was me in the room with my oncology specialist nurse and husband, and she said, do you have children? No. Do you want children? Well, probably not, but we hadn't made a decision. Well, the cancer's big, and we want to stop chemo, and the risks of embryo preservation are too high, so we'll just crack on with chemo, shall we? Now, diarrhea. And that was it. In 30 seconds, my fertility was discussed and dismissed. My husband and I didn't even think to say, can we just step outside and have a private moment to go through this? Now, my own surgeon didn't mention to have a think about fertility at the time, and I don't blame her. We were all crying and in tears. Do you ever discuss fertility with patients? How often do you do it? If you do it once or twice a year, are you an expert in it? Do you go and listen to the gynecologists talk about fertility so you can give patients a warning as to the things they need to think about? I also had the experience to go mystery shopping. It was a Friday night, second cycle of chemotherapy, payday, bank holiday, and I had a temperature. And if your temperature goes above 37.5, you have to get to A&E and have antibiotics in the hour. So 9 o'clock at night, we went to A&E, and the nurses were great. My husband and I decided not to say who we were. So not only have I worked at this hospital as a registrar, My husband's a general consultant. He's been a medical director, an ex-chief exec, and he's now their chief clinical information officer. We're not a normal couple, but we kept quiet. After 3 hours, I was told my white count was really high, they didn't know why, and they put me on a ward at 1 o'clock in the morning. I discovered that no one gets any sleep on an acute hospital ward at night. So when you come round bright and breezy in the morning, hi, how are you? Give the patients a minute. You've got the bing bong, bing, bing bong, bing bong of the drip stands that are going off out of time. They check your OBS every hour, the BMs, the pulse. They don't tell you what they are because they're written down at the mysterious chart at the end of the bed that you can't see because your hand's tied to a drip stand. And then there's a little old man in the bay next to you who every 5 minutes goes, help me, help me, help me. And then over here, there's a little old woman who says, you're a horrid man. And then he says, well, you're a horrid woman. And then the silence of 5 minutes. And then he starts again, help me, help me. When you're feeling really ill, it's really hard to get a good night's sleep. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the medical registrar came in. And this is when I realized that as a consultant, you have no idea what happens under your name in the middle of the night. So his first question was, I'm very busy. I've got another ward to get to. Can I speak to Dermot, my husband? I said, well, he's gone home. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm the patient. He then said, so I gather you know you're being treated for breast cancer. Well, I'm bold. I've been admitted with neutropenic sepsis from chemotherapy. So, yes, I think I do. He then said, are you and Dermot all right at home? Is my husband having an affair? What do you know that I don't? That was his way of asking your social and family history. The only examination he did was to shine his iPhone down my throat, which is apparently a thing now because nobody has pen torches. But I thought, your hands have been in that. Do you wash your hands when you go to the loo? It's been in your pocket. I don't want that near my mouth. He never asked me about the breast cancer, mentioned the treatment, mentioned the chemotherapy. And when he finished, still no wiser as to why I had a high white count, he said, is there anything else you'd like to tell me? And I thought, I'll just let you know. By the way, I'm a breast consultant surgeon, and I've had this, and I've had chemotherapy. And he listened. And then he said, why do they give you chemo first? I never heard of that. I thought, really? You really want a breast cancer lecture at 3 o'clock in the morning? Okay. And his final words to me were, I just want to know, why did you let it get so big? Now, I'll admit, I've said that to breast care nurses in clinic when I've seen women come in with large tumours. How do they not notice it? And I hadn't. But to say that to me, language. You don't realise what words you say when you're tired and it's in the middle of the night. Everything's electronic. Everything's on the computer. When you're seeing patients, at least make some passing comment that you've read the notes and you know what's happened to them. It got better in the morning. So normally on a Saturday, you don't see a physician until about lunchtime. So my husband texted the guy and said, what time are you coming in to see my wife? And he was here at 8:30. The nurse has had a heart attack. There's a physician on a surgical ward at 8:30 in the morning. And he's a friend, and he came in, and there was the FY1 standing in the corner of the door, and he was crying because there was me with no hair, and he wanted to give me a hug and a kiss. And this poor F1 thing, bloody hell, is this a normal ward round? And he then asked me, well, how are you? Fine. Do you know why your white count's so high? Because you're the expert. Well, this is my first admission with a chemotherapy complication, and you haven't told me what my blood tests are. I actually knew through Twitter from a professor I'm told with, and it's the bone marrow injections you have to raise your white count, but they wanted me to be an expert at 8 o'clock in the morning when I've had no sleep. And then he wanted to give me a hug and a kiss as he left, and the poor F1 said, just go, it's fine, he knows me. But you just have to think about your attitude and how you're feeling and how the patients are feeling. So as I said, I was being treated in a hospital where I'm very well known and my husband works. And if it was you, where would you go to be treated? That's the first thing my surgeon asked me, where do you want to get treated? When you know everyone in your field, the good, the bad, the ugly, do you choose location? Do you choose bedside manner? Do you choose technical skills? Do you go NHS or private? That was a really, really hard decision for me. In the end, I trust my surgeon. She trained me. I wanted to stay local. But she had to develop the strength to treat me. If something goes wrong, she sees my husband every day at work. It's a privilege to treat friends and colleagues, but it's also quite mentally tough to be able to distance yourself. And the way we cope was to put our friendship on hold for the duration of treatment. And that was really hard to lose a friend when you're going through chemo. They also asked me, do you want to remain anonymous? Do you want to use a different name? And I apologize for this. The first thing that came to my head was my porn star name, which is the name of your first pet and your mother's maiden name. And mine is Max Love. I couldn't imagine them calling it out in chemo, and I'd never remember it. so I decided to use my own name. I was about to experience everything that I've put my patients through, and I'm embarrassed to admit I didn't know the half of it. I'd never sat and taken the time to ask a patient, what's it really like to have a biopsy? What's it really like to have chemo? I'd never seen the radiotherapy suite and seen just what position the arms needed to go in. I found out that local anaesthetic actually burns. It's not a nettle sting. When you have an MRI in my unit and you stood there naked about to get on the sheet, they put cod liver oil capsules on your nipples as an anatomy marker. Never knew. Chemo, I just thought you lost the hair on your head, but you lose all your body hair. Free Brazilian and leg wax on the NHS. I never knew. General anaesthetic, I didn't realise that in a lot of people, propofol burns. And the last thing I remember before every operation was crying in pain as it went up my arm. Implants are freezing. When you've been outside and you come in to have a shower, it is icy cold. And if you're putting on a roll-on deodorant, you've no idea whether it works because the skin's numb. And cording. I don't know how many of you have heard about cording. Very little is known. It's when tight lymph vessels underneath the skin become thrombosed, and it's like a little guitar string that stops you lifting your arm. I was told, just do your exercises, it'll get better in time. 2 or 3 weeks it wasn't moving, and I had to have my arm above my head to have radiotherapy. They sent me to see the physio in the hospital, finally, after me asking, and she could do shoulder movement, but she wasn't trained in soft tissue release. And I realised very few physios in hospitals are actually trained in treating cancer patients and doing soft tissue release and cupping for cording. I found someone about an hour away, and my radiotherapy was delayed by 3 months because I couldn't get my arm above my head. Do you know what your physios do? Can they do what you need them to? If they can't, do you know other physios in the area to send patients to? Through Twitter, I'm setting up a website called Cancer Physio with a friend that now has, on a map, physios with a location that patients can see. I can go to them, they can fix me. Patients are going to drive the change in the future. I also learned that patients don't tell you how they feel. When I went back after my second operation, I'd spent the month crying all night with neuropathic pain, but I didn't want her to know. I was just grateful, thank you very much. And it was only the breast care nurse who got what I was really feeling. And the gynecology side of the chemomenopause. I can't talk about my sex life in front of my surgeon who works with my husband. It comes down to being part of a team. You need to talk to the breast care nurses. You need to ask them, what did that patient tell you that I need to know that might make me treating them better? And don't take it personally if colleagues don't want to see you, because breast cancer is about as personal as it gets. And on the subject of being personal, to the women in the room, have you ever thought how you feel about your breasts? When you ask women having a mastectomy, they can't think rationally because that breast has cancer in it. And we give them 1, maybe 2 weeks to suddenly go through the whole gamut of sexual identity, body image, sexuality. How do I feel? Do I need it? You have no idea how you're going to feel. I had 5 months of chemo to think whether I wanted a reconstruction or not, and I'm still not sure whether I made the right decision. Just give patients a little bit of time. It's a really hard decision to come up with. And don't force reconstruction on them. There are an awful lot of young women who are very happy to be flat, and they've told me they felt the surgeons pushed reconstruction on them because they were so desperate to do the reconstruction, and they're actually quite happy. What would I do differently in training? Well, as a trainee and a fellow, like most of us, I was obsessed with getting the numbers. I wanted to spend every day operating, and I was wrong. As a fellow, you have the luxury of not being anywhere in one fixed time, and I wish I'd spent more time in the outlying clinics, be able to listen to the luxury of the voice of experience. Patients come and ask you questions about fertility and genetics and family history and menopause. What training do you get as a breast surgical trainee? Go to those clinics, listen to what people can tell you, so you can then tell the GPs, because they have no idea what to do with breast cancer patients who are menopausal when they can't give them HRT. I never did it, and I wish I had. You don't get the time as a consultant. Another thing that came to me, and I'm a bit odd, I'm quite sporty. 8 years ago, I did no exercise. I was the person who joined gyms and then thought of all the shoes I could have bought with the money I threw away on gym memberships. And then I met my husband and became a cycling widow and then a triathlete. And I wanted to know, was it safe to exercise through chemo? And all the cancer websites say, ask your doctor. Well, I'm a doctor. I've never had any training in how much exercise is safe. We all know we should prescribe it. Can I swim during chemo? Can I cycle during chemo? Through Twitter, I found a lot of female professional cyclists who said, we carried on doing what we felt we could because we know our bodies, and we ignored the doctors or we didn't tell them. And I was the same. I did weight training during chemo. I cycled to chemo, and I got told off because my neutrophil count was 0.9. Am I suddenly getting septicemia riding a bike to the hospital? I've got six ducks and a dog at home. I'm more likely to get sick there. I did a sprint triathlon halfway through chemo, very, very, very slowly. But the feel-good factor I got from doing it and achieving it was amazing. But then I had people telling me, you can't get a bus to go to the hospital appointment because of the great unwashed. It's ridiculous. How do we know what's safe and what's not? How many sporty athletes do you see to know, is it safe for them to ride 100 miles 3 weeks after a clearance? Are we too conservative? Which brings me back to all the bake sales to raise money for cancer. Yes, baking's great, but we know that people need to lose weight and get healthy, and we're saying, buy cake, support cancer. I'd love to see hospital park runs where you get people to come and just walk slowly and you get a mental buddy group to encourage people to exercise. That's the rant over. I know I'm not normal compared to a lot of you. Finally, I'm going to come on to IT because we live in an electronic age. How many people here have an iPhone and an iPad and an iWatch? The last time my husband went on holiday, we had two iPhones, two iPads, two iWatches, a laptop, two Kindles and two Garmins. I know, we're not quite normal. But patients are booking appointments on their phones at the age of 80. And how much of the whole IT for healthcare, paperless hospitals, is helping the patients? We made the decision to come out on Twitter. We both pressed the button at the same time, and everyone thought I was mad. Why are you telling the world? It was the best thing I ever did. I got instant support from hundreds of people I'd never met. My husband, it meant that everyone in the hospital where I was being treated knew that if he was having a bad time, they understood he could come out to clinics. I wrote a blog to try and send a positive message about breast cancer because the only blog I'd heard of before was slash poison burn, and that's not a positive message. And I've had amazing response from people saying thank you for telling me what it's like, for understanding what my husband was going through. I found my own tribe. I was amazed at the patient forums, how much they know. Patients go to every conference in the States and feed that information back. And there's people in the UK talking about monoclonal antibody immunotherapy that I'd never heard of. It's their job to know everything they know about their diagnosis. It's your job just to treat them. The times are changing and we're far behind. So in oncology, they have a computer screen and they'd ask me, did you have this side effect? And I wanted to tick all the boxes, you know, to please somebody. And then I was given a photocopy of an information leaflet telling me about chemo. No one told me. They're all available on the website or on the app. You can download them and send to your mum. No, I can't read her a three-page photocopy. It just seems such a discrepancy. Are all your information leaflets on your hospital website so patients can download them and send them to people? Do you tell them they're there? Do you know what apps are available to help your patients? When I had my drains, I was given a piece of paper and a pen to write down the output, but I left it at home. If there was something on my phone goes everywhere with me. I think as doctors, we're very protective of data. We don't want patients to have access to their notes or their records or their images. We don't want patients to contact us by email. We keep them apart. I was able to get my consultant's email address to ask her a question about a trial so she could do her homework before I saw her, but she still didn't like me sending that email. And I think we need to get over ourselves and move more to the way to the States to let patients ask questions. We are nice people, really. If someone asks you, can I have a copy of the mammogram? Do you know how to do that? How much money it would cost? I haven't got a clue. And no one showed me pictures of my MRIs and CTs and bone scans. I had to remember to ask, what did it show? Now I'm thinking, do you want to ask the patient to take a photograph of the scan on the computer screen? It's then their data, it's their job to protect it if they lose it, but they've got that to show their friends and family. Now, I don't know whether this is legal or not, but whenever you break bad news, you say, you're going to remember nothing of what I tell you after this, that's why there's someone with you and we give you all this information. Why wouldn't you ask, do you want to record this consultation on your phone so you can go away and listen to what I've said at a later date? It's very easy as a trainee to get bogged down in all the box ticking to pass the AICP, to get a consultant job. And as a consultant, you get bogged down in the monotony. The clinical side just becomes a job, and there's the politics and the management and the running the unit and the peer review and the audit. At the end of the day, it just becomes a job, and the next patient is just another annoying woman with breast pain. But remember, patients are people. They're scared, they're frightened, they're looking to you to help them, and you'll be one yourself one day. Thank you.